Hello, I'm Dan Safarik. Welcome to Unfrozen. This is episode 110, Incorporating Architects.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and this is our final episode of the year. It's one that I have been very much looking forward to since we started setting it up. Devoted listeners will find some interesting connections here back to episode 90, a year ago, Megalopolis, as we brought in Kate Wagner and others to talk about their fears for the Trump administration. Kate remembered at the time we were speculating on who might build the eventual prison camps and detention centers that that ICE has built, including Alligator Alcatraz. And there was one name at the top of Kate's list, AECOM. Later, in episode 104, in Make Gaza Great Again, we exhumed the deck that has been circling there about the potential reconstruction of Gaza. And again, on multiple slides, who are you going to call when you want to rebuild a country for fun and profit? It's AECOM. And in the interest of full disclosure, I spoke to AECOM's global leadership back in 2016, where I hopefully but probably naively implored them to build the kinds of solutions that the world needs, because as one of their senior vice presidents had said in 2010, we're AECOM. We can do anything. And the more I've learned about that firm, the more that statement actually scares me. And no one has done more to exhume exactly the meaning and potent behind that sentence than our guest today, Aaron Kayer. Aaron is an assistant professor of architecture at Cal Poly Pomona, and he is also the author of Incorporating Architects, How American Architecture Became a Practice of Empire. And Aaron is here today to talk about how AECOM, Borg-like, cancerous-like, I don't know, we'll figure out a metaphor here, grew from a small architecture firm into the globe-spanning infrastructural and management services, as they once called one of their units, housing private prisons, among other things, into the kind of firm that helps deliver that empire. So, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us to a special year-end holiday edition of Unfrozen.
What an introduction. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, there's many places to begin, but let's start with motive here. I guess, sketch out AECOM for our listeners, because obviously its anonymity hiding behind that acronym is really the beginning of the entire story. So what put you on the trail?
Sure. So I first became interested in architecture firms in general while I was an intern architect back in the early 2010s. And while I was working, I found that the procedures of architectural work were incredibly fascinating, but curious because they seem to be so arbitrary and so rigid. And at the time, I was also struck by how little scholarship had existed about architects' work and why businesses were structured in the way that they were. And so the most recent books about architecture firms dated to the 1980s, and they were focused on the small firms and the so-called individual genius architects. And so I decided to study architecture firms and the history of the profession in grad school, and it became clear to me that the biggest change across the field since the 1980s was the kind of economic inequities that had become incredibly pronounced and the ballooning of some of the largest architecture and engineering firms. So in the 80s, a big firm had 100 employees and they were considered large. But by the 2000s, we were talking about 100,000 people working for a single firm. So I initially planned to study a broad range of firms and the post-war conditions that shaped many of them. So I was thinking about Caudill, Rollitt and Scott in Texas and the Architects Collaborative in Massachusetts, or SOM and Gensler and even Zaha Hadid Architects at the time. But as I began studying them, I kept hearing about this firm named Daniel Mann, Johnson & Mendenhall Architects, which was called Dim Jim, and which today is known as the architecture and engineering firm AECOM, which is, as you described, one of the largest of such firms in the US and globally. And the architects that I was interviewing started to describe it as a kind of instigator and as a model. And so it turned out that Dim Jim and AECOM's history was so complicated because the firm was defined by its military contracts, and many of the architects there had these really deep political alliances with military commanders and the Army and the Air Force and even presidents like Nixon and Reagan. So the firm itself, as a single case study rather than as an exception, started to kind of reveal a far more complex story of architecture practice than I had imagined in or learned about in architecture school. And so I decided to just focus on AECOM in as much detail as I could. And even in all of this, I'm sure there's enough material for someone else to write another two or three books about AECOM, let alone any of these other architecture corporations.
Well, I was going to say, I guess the question, what is AECOM? And I don't mean it like, don't list its business units, but fundamentally, what is this enterprise about? Because yeah, the way you describe it and the scale of it is, it's closer, on paper at least, to a Halliburton or a Bechtel, or these giant infrastructure firms that are tied up into American empire. We think of an architecture firm, and the largest self-proclaimed architecture firm in the world is Gensler, which is a fraction of its size. So what exactly does AECOM do at a fundamental level, because it's so entwined with those kinds of, you know, state-level functions?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's one that, as you alluded to at the beginning, they can do anything at this point. So what does that actually mean, and what does it mean for an architect or an engineer to work there? I think their origin is an interesting and complicated story, just even thinking about what the A, the E, the C, the O, and the M actually mean. And I don't think that many of the leaders at AECOM or even the architects working there understand the full extent of it. So if we go backward just for a second, DIMJIM, the firm that kind of birthed AECOM, was a partnership, and it was named after the original partners of the company, Daniel Mann Johnson and Mendenhall. And in the post-war period, they were an architecture firm, and then they folded in engineering. But as the first generation of leaders passed away, the kind of individual names of the firm lost significance. But DIMJIM was then acquired by an oil company, Ashland Oil Company, in the middle of the 1980s, so that the firm's CEO at the time, an architect and engineer, Al Dorman, could lead their engineering division. So this was then called Ashland Technology Corporation, and it was abbreviated as ATC on the stock market, and this becomes important later on. But it was also a strategy that the oil company was using to dodge antitrust sanctions so they could diversify in engineering and architecture and avoid any sanctions about monopoly. But in any case, by the 1990, Ashland decided that they no longer wanted to become embedded in engineering, and so they decided to sell these engineering and architecture companies. But the architects and the engineers didn't want that to happen. They wanted to maintain control, so they initiated an employee-led buyback, and they then formed this company called AECOM, Technology Corporation. So they actually kept the ATC, AECOM Technology Corporation, on the stock market for this kind of easy transition from Ashland to AECOM. But the new name, AECOM, was no longer attached to any individual person or the founding partners. And it was reduced to these anonymized services. However, according to the CEO, the first CEO of AECOM, Al Dorman, the late Al Dorman, the name also provided for some kind of flexible, open-ended possibilities, he argued. So A and E were clear, architecture and engineering, yet the COM, in his view, was specifically open-ended. So he argued it was a kind of testament to the possibilities of late capitalism. So it could be used to suggest construction, operations, and management, or even contracts, operations, and maintenance, or construction management. And today, I think most think of the COM as construction, operations, and management, though the firm really describes itself as a maintenance firm today. And so I really have no idea if they are actively redefining those letters as they go, or if they've sort of just accepted the AECOM as a single brand. But truly, anything that's involved in the built environment, they seem to have their hands in.
All right, well, the last question before I hand it over to Dan here to start drilling in is who are their clients? Because that's the thing about AECOM, right? They are the almost uniquely positioned a firm with scale and capabilities where they could initiate their own projects practically. Like, you know, John Portman did that back in the day, but they could raise money, they could develop their own things. But instead, you really lay out how instead they became entwined with the United States federal government and other entities instead. So how would you describe their business practices in terms of how they see, if they can do anything, what is it they choose to do and why?
Great question. You alluded to, or you mentioned Halliburton and Bechtel in the previous question. And I think in many ways, they're similar to those companies in the way that they structure themselves and go after particular projects. And I think the technology aspect of this is a kind of clue to the kinds of projects that they're after. Those that can really get at a kind of underbelly of other projects. So they're not necessarily interested in single buildings, but they're actually interested in the relationships between buildings or the structures that hold them together. Because this is not only where the money is, but it's also where the control and power comes from. And I think any firm that really begins in one industry, but that also has a real thirst for profit and expansion by kind of any means necessary is going to share a similar history and a pattern. So this is why Bechtel and AECOM might be similar, right? So Halliburton started in oil industry in the early 1900s, Bechtel in engineering in the 1890s, and even URS, which is now owned by AECOM, actually began after Dim Jim in the 1950s as an engineering firm. And now they all sort of similarly describe themselves in vague terms like maintenance or infrastructure, because they've continued to kind of zoom out from a single industry and start to acquire others. And that really requires them to focus more on the management of these various industries rather than any single one. But I think another relationship between many of them is actually how they grew and how they got these projects that really set them off. And a lot of that has to do with the government and military contracts. And so they procured these large development projects, international development projects, and military commissions prior to the Brooks Act of 1972, which was an act that tried to regulate which architects and engineers should be getting government contracts. So you had to kind of demonstrate that you had experience, that you had qualifications and expertise. But before that, it was sort of, whoever you knew would lead to commissions. And so they really were built up by these commissions because they had friends in high places. And so they were able to get these massive contracts without much experience or expertise in any military work. The leaders of Bechtel, for example, were known to be frequent guests at the Bohemian Grove, the noted gentlemen's club in Northern California, which is where CEOs and presidents still to this day meet in the summers to discuss things off the record. And this is where Oppenheimer once discussed the atomic bomb. But also it's where presidents like Reagan and Nixon frequented, and their chiefs of staff. But it wasn't just Bechtel. So Dim Jim and later AECOM's leaders were also there. And so there's a kind of deeply social connection that runs through all of them. So you can imagine if a president or of any country, not necessarily just the United States, is describing their, oh, well, we have this need for a massive infrastructure or highway project at the Bohemian Grove, you can imagine how these things were then negotiated and awarded.
So it completely tracks that, during the post-war period, the size of the federal government grew enormously as the Cold War was prosecuted, and that companies that wanted to, serve in that market would also need to diversify because they wanted to be able to catch the business wherever it hit. There's a parallel trend that people have studied a lot or talked about or complained about a lot in the architecture industry, which is basically that the overall business and legal apparatus of the business has made it harder and harder for the traditional architecture firm to keep control of projects, to kind of make a name for themselves, to make a buck. So I'm wondering how those two narratives intersect, where the architect, keeps getting smaller and smaller in terms of their project role, and more consultants keep getting added to the chain of command. Is this kind of a reaction to that, or is it more from the top down, where the sort of conditions of post-war military expansion and the sort of military-industrial complex? Maybe both. Maybe the answer is both.
Yeah, we hear this a lot, I think, especially that architects have little agency or value in the public realm now, especially maybe the boutique firm or the small architect. And I wouldn't say that firms like AECOM or even Dim Jim were necessarily reactions to this trend, because in many ways I think they produced it. So professional work within, let's say, a broad capitalist system typically trends toward fragmentation because it's lucrative. So the real innovation in their model, in my view, it was the thinking about ways to fragment work. So how do you separate the building's skin from the structural core? And then you might take out construction management out of the kind of historical role of the architect and then make it an entirely new profession, right? Or we can think about landscape architecture or planning or interior design or graphic design. Most of these were then produced as professions by these corporations during this period. And so once they're then separated, well, then you can add them as a separate service to your company. Or even have a separate company within your enterprise that does all of these different things, and then you can charge for both of those services separately. But even architects like Michael Graves during the postmodern period were charging for multiple services, graphic design services and architecture services. So it was a kind of ubiquitous economic strategy. And I think there are architects who were and who are still to this day trying to reclaim some of this and try to broadcast real value. Like I think of Gluck Plus or Peter Gluck's firm, for example, by thinking about the ways that they're expanding architecture into design build and kind of reclaiming the construction parts of the practice. But I think it will always be tempting to separate the services because that's just how it becomes lucrative, right? And how you actually fragment your liability. So if you don't want to be liable for the construction part, you have a separate entity, right? And so I think the question of how you reclaim some of this without defaulting to separate businesses is actually an interesting challenge, but one that requires some form of advocacy from political associations because they're no longer understood to be the work of design in a legal or ethical sense, right? If you're engaging in real estate, you're not necessarily engaging in architecture per se. But I think this is also very fun to discuss with students who don't necessarily have this full picture of history. I once had a student who argued that we could never reclaim these expertise, like engineering, as architects, because our brains have evolved and we can't absorb, all that each profession has expanded to be. And so I think this biological argument makes me laugh in the moment, but I find myself continuously thinking about it. And perhaps there's some truth to it when we think about the impacts that technology and social media have had on our knowledge bases and our attention span and all of these kinds of things. So, yeah, not so much a reaction, but I think they really produced this trend.
All right, so related to that, looking sort of the post-Cold War environment of what e-com is now. So I mentioned at the outset, and I will say, legal disclaimer here, there is no evidence that AECOM has done any work for ICE. And also, there's no evidence that AECOM volunteered its logo to appear in the Make Gaza Great Again deck, that they, of course, lifted a lot of different logos. But it is interesting that you think of AECOM when you think of a job like that. And so I'm curious, Aaron, your thoughts on sort of how AECOM fits into sort of the contemporary approach to city making and large-scale giga projects that's practiced in the Gulf, because one of my obsessions here, as we know, is like, you saw management consultancies, McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, Oliver Wyman, and others move into the space where they write the briefs and they're defining these large scale things. And, architects and urban planners sort of became downstream of that. How does AECOM fit into this sort of modern landscape in terms of the expertise it's able to bring and the scale of the conception of projects that it's able to do in a world of giga projects, particularly in the Gulf, other sort of global South milieus kind of thing? How do they position themselves that way?
Yeah, I think maybe as a full disclosure, I haven't studied the kind of all of the contemporary practices of AECOM and what it has become. I try to leave that or leave the history in the early 1990s and not speculate where they're going or to try to figure out what they've become. But you're right. I think in the ways that the management consulting firms sort of drove these practices. So Booz Allen and Hamilton was the practice that initially was hired to structure Dim Jim in the early days. They were also working for the architecture firm Perkins & Will. And Booz Allen and Hamilton, still to this day, is a primary consultant for the government, for the NSA. This is Edward Snowden, rings a bell, was working for Booz Allen Hamilton, for example. And they started to structure these architecture firms like these management consulting firms. So they actually organize themselves exactly like the management consulting practices. So then you have to think, well, what is actually different about them? And some of the things that recently private equity companies have started to say is that they're looking to companies like AECOM and architecture and engineering companies as a way to understand assets and portfolio diversification, because they argue that architects have a unique skill of understanding how people interact and how business relations and managerial relations are actually kind of made efficient. So they're actually studying architects and engineers to understand capital and capital management. So maybe a kind of broad way of getting at this more contemporary question. But yeah, I think it does start with these management consulting firms. But if we take a step further and think a little bit about where the management consulting firms were gaining their experience, we have to then look at the U.S. military. So they were first gaining their experience and their expertise from the ways that the Army and the Navy and the Air Force were being organized. And one of the first tasks was, how do you scale up, especially during war, how do you scale up these various military branches without any redundancy? So how do you make sure that the Army is the Army and not the Air Force, and the Air Force is not the Navy, et cetera, et cetera? So a lot of those skills came from the military that were then passed on to the management consulting firms that were then passed on to these architecture firms.
What I think was kind of interesting, I guess I want to discuss a little bit of the subject of criticism here, both in the sense of formal architecture criticism and this and public criticism of business practices. So there's some really interesting details in the book that have not a great deal to do with architecture and design, but which the architecture and design community actually celebrated at the time, which is pretty interesting. They had a standards and practices manual that specified things such as the maximum employee age, which today would be called age discrimination, but was considered, you know, progressive at the time, and maximum amount that could be spent on funeral condolence flowers. They had every detail down. And it was celebrated in the pages of Progressive Architecture, which was owned by Litton Industries, a defense contractor, which sounds so ironic that I saw shades of like Thomas Pynchon in that. Maybe that's a bit of a stretch, but did anyone in architecture criticism or the broader culture at the time call out these practices as not being very progressive or put them in the same bucket as military contractors who were obviously profiting from the war? But, you know, I'm just wondering how the public perception of this was handled. Did people just think it was like a boring, faceless corporation that was inscrutable?
Sort of. and I think it's actually no coincidence that the crying of Lot 49 was also published in 1965, when this is the same moment when these architects were writing these detailed protocols and business handbooks. But to your question, yeah, not really. I think for one, it's hard to see that what you might be doing or writing in the moment is somehow odd or not progressive. So it wasn't necessarily odd at the time for a woman to lose their job, for example, when they became pregnant, or when someone reached the age of 65, right? And they were considered too old to work. So in fact, it was the kind of opposite. So as I mentioned, it was the management consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton that was advising these companies to be more efficient, and to make a lot more money, you had to be dispassionate, they argued. So this echoes the work of sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, who argues that if you're in it for the money, you have to really be dispassionate to move forward. But I think for the architecture critics, this was a new form of practice that followed a bureaucracy model rather than an artistic genius model. And so it was interesting to them precisely because it wasn't about passion, I suppose. And it was considered uniquely American Because of the kind of mechanistic approaches to work and the massive scales of production that they could achieve. So I'm thinking also about the work of Albert Kahn and his work for the Ford factory, which really epitomizes this kind of a very American form of practice. And the historian Claire Zimmerman has recently published a great book about this. So there was really no calling out, I'd say, of the company by the media, though at the time, the details of the business manuals were also not widely known. So their protocols, after all, were their secret sauce, and they still operate in this way. For instance, the man who led the computer services division, who was a young architecture graduate, Vahe Kachuni, he would go around to the American Institute of Architects in various states and teach architects the basics of how to use computers and programs like Fortran. And he would actually leave out details, like the one program that they had developed internally that made lines disappear computationally and that they were using to actually draw city skylines. Or another example, I once found one of these incredibly comprehensive business manuals that was archived at the Huntington Library in California as part of these papers of an architect, Arthur Mann, who was one of the partners. But in it, there was a missing organization chart that was a sort of spiral organization diagram that tried to de-emphasize the top-down approach to management for the sake of the employees, to say, look, you're not just at the bottom of this hierarchy, you're part of this spiral, this more complex egalitarian whole. And I asked the company about this, and they searched through their records, and they couldn't find it. And then I asked some of the CEOs, the early CEOs, like Al Dorman, and he would tell me all about it. Oh, how amazing this organization chart really is, and this was such an important diagram for us, but I can't share that with you. So there was just a lot of this, even to this day in their history. But I would say one last thing about these kind of call-outs of criticism is that there were actually a couple of instances that I describe in the book where the practices got them in trouble and that they were called out, not necessarily by critics, but actually by the courts, even though they weren't reported in architecture journals or architecture magazines. So Dim Jim was embroiled in one investigation in particular over quid pro quos arrangements with the Republican Party in the 1960s. And in the case, the state of Massachusetts revealed there was a whole network of architecture firms that secured public contracts for really large commissions, including some community colleges, in exchange for campaign contributions to the Republican Party, including efforts to re-elect Nixon. And they would transfer money in small bills, in briefcases, from international banks, and then they would make these donations in hotel rooms in Massachusetts. And the donations for the RNC were made in fake names, so they would never be traced back to Dim Jim or to any architect. But even more damning, the resulting buildings were often rushed and they were structurally dangerous. And so all of this actually undermined the very justifications for the profession and licensure itself, which was really to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. So while critics were not paying attention to this, there are some paper trails where you can start to see people being called out or practices being called out.
All right, well, speaking of paper trails, since you've already hinted at it, it seems like an opportune time to dive into that. So Dan and I, of course, are both former, and I'm still an occasional journalist, and I think we're both in awe of the research that you had to conduct for this book. So a two-part question to wind you up. One, how did AECOM executives react when you told them that you were going to write this book and you wanted to interview them and dive into the archives? And two, please tell us where the majority of those archives are kept and why.
Yes, I think I was naive when I began the project and thought, oh yeah, they'll open their vaults and they'll open their archives and it'll be an easy project. The first day that I went there, they said, architecture history, why are you interested in studying us? What about us are you interested in? And so initially they said that they would grant me access on a select basis or a case-by-case basis to various materials. So drawings or business records that they would have to look for. And so I would come up with a list of things and send them to them, and then they would say that they didn't have any files of those names. Then there was an issue with accessing the records. There was an administrative assistant who was the only person in the office that knew how to access the database of the archives. And so everyone was really wed to her, and then she left the firm, and then they had no way of really accessing a lot of the information. And so then it became a legal battle, and so I started to request drawings, and they said, well, they have to go through legal review. And so I was back and forth with the company's counsel, and they eventually said, no, we can't grant you any access to these records because they might expose our clients. They said clients in a very vague sense to liability. And by clients, they were talking about the government, really. And so I didn't really have much success with their archives or their materials, though they did give me some self-written histories of their company, which were interesting just to see what they prioritized and how they framed themselves over the span of several decades. And then I ended up speaking with some of these former employees and former CEOs who had kept many records. Then there were paper trails at various archives and government archives and in libraries like the Huntington Library. I submitted a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests so I could access drawing records for ballistic missile prototypes and things like that. And actually, the government was very willing to share anything. So I have a 1,000-page construction set to build a ballistic missile facility if anyone's interested. I don't know why this is so easy to obtain. Of course, yeah, if you also need about millions and millions of dollars to be able to pull one of these things off, but just the kind of information that they were willing to let go, but then also like a letter about a CIA record would be something that they wouldn't share. So sort of interesting to see what they were willing to share or what they weren't willing to share, and by they, I mean the government. And so later in the history, there was a, or later in the research, I should say, there was an archivist who found access or gained access to the archives and sent me an Excel file of thousands and thousands of boxes that had some affiliation with DIMJIM in the early days of AECOM. And so I looked at this Excel file, and they were all labeled with numbers, like, serial numbers, and thousands of boxes, and no description of what's in those boxes. And he argued, that's all we have. That's the only information we have. So you can pick a few, and you can have access to those, but that's it. So I thought, how am I ever going to decide which five boxes of these, 10,000 boxes I'll be able to access? And it seems silly. And I learned that those boxes were stored in Iron Mountain, which is a massive storage company today that also has its roots in nuclear protection and started actually as an Iron Mountain in upstate New York. And so many of the archives or many of the boxes are stored there in vaults in Iron Mountain. And there's a very difficult path to access those. But I guess if someone is willing to sift through 55,000 boxes one at a time, then perhaps they'd be willing to allow you to go through even more records. But again, I have no idea what's even in them.
I'll let Dan go from here, but I just want to note for listeners, Iron Mountain, of course, is basically, yeah, like a bunker for government paperwork. And of course, the site of the famous satire taken as reality, the report from Iron Mountain, which argued that civilization would collapse if we don't fight for war. So there's a really nice irony in that one, that that's where AECOM's archives would be stored. But Dan, back to you.
Yeah, that you can't make that up. That is, I think the other thing that comes to mind is Dr. Strangelove for some reason. Probably also not coincidental, it came out in that period. A lot of suspicion of this massive underbelly of our government and industry. So one thing we haven't talked much about is architectural design. And of course, that's not really what the firm is known for, nor even really the reason why you studied it. But they did produce a few notable architects and notable buildings out of all this. And I'm wondering, you know, what kind of environment it was like to work in, you know, where you, everything is depersonalized, everything is mechanized, everything's very organized. But you have individuals like Cesar Pelli, who became a global architecture name, who emerged from what was then Dim Jim, and to a somewhat lesser degree, Anthony Lumsden, who is kind of a Southern California celebrity architect, if you will. How do their stories fit into the narrative of this constantly expanding Borg? Are they outliers?
At first glance, I think they do seem like outliers because they were designers whose names and reputations resemble the older model of a personality-led firm with the architect and their name on the door. And in this sense, they were. But while AECOM's name ultimately erased its founders, Dim Jim did really produce architects who became publicly legible as authors in the ways that might seem contradictory. So Pelli and later Lumsden won quite a few design awards, and they appeared in magazines and really helped elevate the cultural perception of these large corporate firms, especially in Los Angeles. So their mirror glass office buildings, for example, challenged the kind of anonymity of standardized corporate architecture and placed Dim Jim, surprisingly, in the same conversation as architects like Craig Ellwood and Ray Cappy and John Lautner and even Frank Gehry. But this visibility came with a contradiction. In a conglomerate that's built on mergers and acquisitions and internal equivalency, no person was supposed to become more valuable than the system itself. And so Pelli wasn't really a great fit for the corporate practice, and he left Dim Jim after a few years in 1968. But Lumsden stepped in as the design director, and his work became increasingly important to how the firm understood itself. So he became what colleagues described as a spokesperson for design, someone who could translate between systems and engineering and management and architecture and kind of make visible the economic and organizational value of architectural thinking at a moment when the profession was starting to feel threatened by automation and mass production. So Lumsden also rejected this kind of genius or star system, and he argued that it actually encouraged architects to withdraw from the real conditions of practice, so withdrawing from economics and technology and environmental systems. But by the early 1990s, AECOM had hired a new team of corporate leaders to join the company from SOM, and they did not fully understand his role or the role that a designer like Lumsden would play in such an enterprise. And they saw his kind of concentrated agency as a liability because they couldn't make design decisions without him. And so in 1993, at, again, the age of 65, which was the maximum age allowable at Dim Jim, he was fired. And one colleague recalled watching this all go down that the so-called bean counters worried that he had become larger than the entire system and that they had to change the, quote, effing design culture here. So I think to get back to this question, I think Pelli and Lumsden were not necessarily exceptions to the corporate machine, but they were kind of temporary products of it, if that makes sense.
Super interesting. There's one other individual that I want to talk about, which is, again, sort of a side story, but gets into this whole nexus between the military, industrial, and the entertainment complex that, you know, was the two overlapping Venn diagrams of Southern California, and that is Jack Martin, who was a set designer, I believe, on The Wizard of Oz, and then later ended up doing architectural renderings for Dim Jim. And somehow his story relates into this idea of the concept of the Hollywood hard missile silo and the hard missile silo. So maybe we can disambiguate all that.
Yeah, what's fascinating about Jack Martin Smith, he was a set designer and later art director, and his role in this story is how seamlessly the Cold War military architecture borrowed from Hollywood's way of shaping belief. So as we've discussed, firms like Dim Jim weren't just designing buildings anymore, single buildings. They were designing systems and relationships and perceptions of things and people. And so when the Air Force launched the Titan I missile program, which was intended to be the U.S.'s kind of first fully hardened underground ballistic missile system, it wasn't only about engineering as a weapon, but about staging a kind of performance of deterrence. This was kind of the ideas of JFK. And this is where architecture started to have, or started to behave less like construction and more like choreography. So there were underground silos and there were control centers and power systems that were arranged not just to function, but actually to signal strength and resilience. And so this idea of Hollywood hard missile silos captures this. And so some of the Titan sites were truly hardened, meaning that they were buried deeply underground, that they were massively reinforced and built to survive even a nuclear blast. But others, especially the training facilities or the testing facilities, only looked hard from above ground. And so the military described these as Hollywood hard. And so above ground, they appear just as formidable, but beneath the surface, they had thinner walls and simpler structures. And the difference was kind of concealed in the drawings and renderings that kind of smoothed over these distinctions, especially for other countries that would be looking at what's going on here. And so this is where Jack Martin Smith enters the picture. And he was trained as an architect who studied with Johnson and Daniel at the University of Southern California. And rather than going into architecture practice, he went into set design, which was incredibly common at the time. So they were graduating in the late 1930s. And set design was actually a requirement for architects. It was a required part of their curriculum. And he designed sets for films like Cleopatra and Planet of the Apes and Fantastic Voyage, as well as The Wizard of Oz. And he was hired then by Dim Jim to produce these dramatic renderings of the Titan missile silo, like launching, and these really soft pastel drawings that kind of echoed the visual language of Emerald City. So if you ever look at Emerald City as a kind of series of clustered test tubes, upturned test tubes, it's hard not to then see it like a cluster of missiles that are looking like they're ready to launch as part of this kind of theatrical realism, is what they described it in Hollywood. So the missile becomes kind of this both real and mythic backdrop. And, you know, the question is, would it actually work in war? Who knows, right? But that didn't really matter, because I think it pressed the world into order. But one last thing about this, I think that when we connect these ideas of deterrence to practice and expertise, a firm could easily claim that they were experts in something, but it would be difficult to know whether or not they actually had experience doing anything like that, especially as they were becoming a corporation that was more abstracting the individual work or the individual expertise. So this was a primary way that they actually received their commissions, like military bases. They had never designed a military base ever. They were architects of small school buildings, and they were then constructing this image of themselves as much larger and more capable than they ultimately got it done. And so I think a lot of this kind of idea of deterrence and inflating oneself, and also inflating one's value, they've been sued for inflating their value on the stock market as well. So inflating value in many ways, I think, stems from this early Cold War military entertainment industrial complex.
All right, so love this era. And I say, for listeners, there's a great book if you love this. There's, of course, the famous Mad Men episode where Don Draper goes to California and see this. And I have a wonderful book called Another Science Fiction that has some of the great ad campaigns of like the Cold War. So I can totally envision this fantasia. But I want to pivot here, Aaron, as we sort of enter the home stretch and ask what the reaction to your book has been, particularly from AECOM employees. So obviously you end in the 90s. But, you know, I met, for example, I won't say who, but I met an AECOM architect this fall and told them about your book and how excited I was to have you on the podcast and asked them if they'd heard of it or read it or if the firm was discussing it. And they had not heard of it. And this is someone, of course, who, you know, joined via recentish acquisition. When I told them what the book was about, sort of like shuddered and was like, I would believe it kind of thing. So it is this question. Obviously, we all make accommodations with our employers. That is the nature of late capitalism. But I am curious what you've heard from the company, any angry letters or any kind of legal actions, but then also from rank and file practitioners who labor knowing but not knowing what the bowels they're in kind of thing.
Yeah, I think maybe to start with the rank and file, I've received quite a lot of messages from people who work there that had no idea about this broader history. And they sort of say oftentimes, wow, I had no idea what I was part of. And you know, they argue like, oh, we're not necessarily disagreeing or necessarily saying that the book doesn't depict the practice accurately, but they're sort of overwhelmed by the broader history of...
Yeah, no, the evil's over there.
Right,
we're doing
right.
good stuff in this part, but the evil's really over there. Wow, this place is evil. But like, no, we're doing some good work here.
Exactly. Or we're just paying the bills, right? This is also the question that I get from students, right? Like, oh, it's a good job. They're paying, you know, they have great benefits, et cetera, so should I not work there? But in terms of the reaction from the company itself, there are two different sort of classes. I think one are... One class is employees that work there and that no longer work there. And they're, I think, proud in some ways of the legacy of the company in the way that they were able to have political impact, which is not to say that like everything was necessarily bad. I think that they did a lot for bolstering the architecture and engineering profession and the value of the architect and the engineer. Whether or not we still adhere to that or not is up for debate, and whether or not we still think that this is the kind of value that architects or engineers should have. And for those that are still at the company, they signed off on everything that I wrote. And so every oral history that I did, I shared transcripts with them. They edited them to make sure that they were exactly how they wanted to be depicted. Every quote, every image had to be vetted and had to be approved by their counsel. And so I tried to be as careful as possible in making sure that this is an accurate history, not just a sort of attack on the company and what they had become, or necessarily even a judgment on what they're up to these days. The book came out even before finished writing the book before they were involved in the Ukraine, or before they were even involved in speculating in Gaza. And so I haven't really received any critiques or any lawsuits, fingers crossed, and never will, from AECOM. Though there are oftentimes legal reviews that take a long time. So I've done a series of interviews with different journals, and some of these get caught up with because of liability and libel. So just because they want to make sure that what I'm saying or what I wrote is actually accurate. And so there are still a couple of these that are still caught in legal review. So we'll see what happens with those. But for the most part, I think they accept that this is their history, and they don't necessarily disagree with the facts of what came before them. And I also think that most of them didn't know what came before them, and the full extent of what is going on even outside of their own office, right? Like AECOM is such a massive enterprise that what's going on in one office is not often known by what's going on in another office.
Well, my recommendation for anyone who has not yet read the book is to get the book and sit down with a nice glass of rye and pull out your ashtray, start running your reel-to-reel UNIVAC, threaded preferably with Dark Side of the Moon going backwards, and put a Kubrick film on, and you pretty much, you're in the zone. Aaron, I want to thank you so much for joining us. This is Incorporating Architects, How American Architecture Became a Practice of Empire by Aaron Kerr. Another episode of Unfrozen. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. This was fun.